It seems he was whittling away even as a little lad growing up. They still called it whittling when he was serving his country in World War II, even when he stunned a superior officer into silence with his remarkable skills as a worker in wood. Emil Milan went from strength to strength, from the Art Students League of New York to creating high-profile production pieces in New Jersey. Eventually dissatisfied, though, with the related stresses of such work, Milan moved on to a barn studio here in Susquehanna County, in Thompson, having become a true master of his craft, a teacher, and an artist of real significance, with work held in the collections of the Smithsonian American Museum of Art, the Yale University of Art Gallery, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, to name a few. But
for a period of time, let's say from almost 1985 until 2007, there was virtually nothing that was ever done with regard to Emil Milan as a notable woodworker. There was absolutely nothing. Until one day when my former wood apprentice, Norm Sartorius, his wife brought a piece to show him that he had made for his mother, and she compared it to a piece that she had gotten for him that Emil had made. He had never met Emil, but having apprenticed with myself and my wife, he heard a great deal about him. And Norm's wife said, "There is really a similarity between the two of you." Norm thought about it and said, "You know, I didn't realize how much influence this man had on my life and my work." So he picked up the phone and he called me and he said, "What can you tell me about Emil Milan?" That was the $64,000 question, I guess.
Phil Juris articulating the question that has led to a quest, a 10-year quest, carried out by Phil Juris, joined by Norm Sartorius and Barry Gordon, each an artist in wood in his own right. How is it that such silence was left in the wake of Emil Milan's life at his passing? And shouldn't something be done to reverse that? All we need to do is take one look at the compelling photograph of Emil Milan at his workshop threshold to feel the power and presence of this larger-than-life figure. And the image is a clue, perhaps, to the answers the Milan team uncovered, not simply the facts of a life, but rather a sense of the vibrancy of that life, a sense that the silence was not a snuffing out or an emptiness, but that such silence might reveal so much about Emil Milan, the man, and his personality. The speaking he did was with his materials, the various woods, the walnut, the teak, the cedar, and such. These quiet conversations with wood led to a remarkable body of work, which, having now been brought to light again and catalogued, speak volumes about the power and presence of Emil Milan, with an influence that has had international ripples. Artist Phil Juris, who knew Emil Milan and considered him a mentor, paid a visit to the WVIA studios to speak on behalf of the other members of the Milan research team, artists Barry Gordon and Norm Sartorius, who didn't know Milan but who experienced his influence in their own work and that of others they know and respect. The occasion for the visit is the approaching publication of a major illustrated biography titled Emil Milan, Mid-Century Master, by Craig Edelbrock, professor and dean at the University of Alabama, with Gordon, Sartorius, and Juris. We began with the overall significance of Emil Milan, who spent so much time here, living and working in our region.
We found through our research that he was a contemporary of people, woodworkers in particular, who were noted woodworkers or who have been recognized as noted woodworkers. Wharton Escherich being one of them, George Nakashima, Wendell Castle. Those are some of the names of people with whom Emil's work was shown in a number of exhibitions dating back from the 50s into the 1960s. But he never really sought nor did he get the kind of recognition that those people attained. And it was our purpose that we were going to lift up his work and get it to the level where he would have the status that his work and his life really deserve.
You were good enough to bring examples, large some of them, representing different types of work that he did, each one showing the affinity he had with the material, with the wood. Tell us a little bit about these pieces, if you would, Phil.
Yes, he definitely had an eye, which was quite evident apparently early on when he was probably an elementary school student, because one of his teachers, we learned, asked him, her brother had become a veterinarian, she asked him if he would carve a cow for her. So apparently he carved a cow for his school teacher. As I was saying, he had an eye, he was perceptive, he could see things and do them without having a model or a form in front of him, which probably was part also of the education that he got at the Art Students League in New York, because three of his instructors, who were well-known sculptors, all sculpted in a direct method of working directly in the material as opposed to making a maquette or a small model or having a photograph. So Emil probably had a really great, well, he had a great eye. The one piece that's here in front of us is a torso that he did for my wife and myself. I said we swapped a walnut tree for it. It's done in teak. It was in a major exhibition, and after it came back from that exhibition, he brought it to the house so we would have it. It is exquisite as far as every detail of this figure is concerned. And one story I like to tell is that I had two visiting nurses come into my home one day, and they came over and looked at this figure, and they literally went over it with a fine-tooth comb, and they said, anatomically, this figure is perfect.
In terms of its balance, grace, there's a tension there, spirit and life.
Yes, it is definitely a sense of life in it.
He can work in a smooth way, but the rough cut just enhances the dynamism of the piece.
Yes, on this piece you can see his chisel marks where he used them. Now, he did the figurative work primarily when he came out of the Art Students League, but it wasn't necessarily a moneymaker. And when he went into the Buckridge Contemporary Design, he was doing more utilitarian pieces because those were the things that were being sold. Those have a whole different feel to them, although the feel, the touch, the tactile experience is really critical to all of the pieces that I think Emil, that I've ever seen Emil do. He moved into the functional pieces, doing bowls and doing utensils. When he moved up to Thompson, Pennsylvania, he continued to do that, but he was also much more aware of his surroundings, and many of the pieces that he did in Thompson were pieces that are either fish forms or leaf forms or birds. And birds were very much a part of his repertoire as far as the sculpture is concerned. So sitting on the desk is a ruffed grouse, which is, I believe, the Pennsylvania state bird. He did a number of those, and he used his sense of the wood. This particular piece is walnut, but he used his sense of where the sap and the heartwood were in the wood that he was working on. So you can see the sapwood would be the lighter, the heartwood would be the darker. And there's where the wings are is the sapwood. At the crown of the bird's head is the sapwood. The rest of it is heartwood, except up in the raised tail where there's sapwood around the outside edge. Looking at it, and of course thinking about Thanksgiving, the tail almost reminds me of a turkey's tail and the feathers around the outside, but definitely you can kind of see the feather effect just by the color of the wood. One of the nice things about this book is we have quite a number of photographs of the birds in the book. They vary as far as the types and the styles, but you can always pick out an Emil Milan bird, because one of his statements was to a fellow artist who was working on something. He said, don't make a potato. It was round and it was curved, but it was completely round. And If you look at Amel's pieces, you'll notice that there is always a plane along. So on this bird, and you can feel it, it comes to an edge as you flow back along the wing section. There's something of a plane at the tip of his head. And that's true with all of the pieces that he did that are like that. And definitely it's not a potato. It gives it a whole different appearance. One of the first birds I ever made, I carved out of cedar. And when I look at that, I can see what Amel meant by having a plane, because mine looks more like a potato.
What, as a group, did you hope? Did you have specific goals? Like, we'll do a show, or we'll do a catalogue raisonné, or were you just finding your way?
We were finding our way, more or less. We didn't really have, other than looking to find out more about Amel, we did not have any particular goals in mind. Although at one point, Norm was at a seminar in North Carolina, and somebody came up to him and he was talking about this research project, which we were kind of carrying and funding out of our own pockets. And they said, you should apply for a grant. The Center for Craft, Creativity, and Design does issue grants, and maybe you should apply for one. So Norm came back and said, do you think we should apply for a grant from the CCCD? And we said, well, we've never done anything like that before, but it sure would help us a lot if that would be a possibility. So he made the arrangements, and we sat down over an intense period of time. It was sometimes 24/7, it seemed, for several months, that we worked on writing a grant, which, of course, we had never done before, as we had never done this type of research before. And we submitted the grant to the CCCD, and wouldn't you know, we were given a major grant from them. We were selected, and I think we were one of 14 grants that were issued by the CCCD, which then enabled us to have some financial wherewithal that we could continue to pursue the research. And we also had a goal, because now we had to fulfill the requirements of the grant, which we had stipulated. This was what we were going to do. This is when we're going to do it. And from there, that was what we did. So we were able to do that in 2009. We submitted the archival work that we had put together, and it went to the CCCD, Center for Craft, Creativity, and Design in North Carolina, part of the University of North Carolina. It went to a number of other institutions, 9 other institutions, including the Smithsonian in Washington, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the Susquehanna Historical Society up here in this area, the Peters Valley Craft School, and the Yale Art Gallery in New Haven, to name just several of those. Still, at that point, we kind of thought, well, maybe our task was done. But our task was not done, because at a show in Philadelphia that Norm was showing his wood spoon work, his marvelous spoons, a man came up to him and introduced himself as a budding woodworker who started a conversation with Norm and said he was really interested in learning more. And Norm again started talking about Amel, and I guess what we call the Amel bug kind of got into this man's ear, and he became interested in it. He happened to be, at that point, the chancellor at the Penn State campus in Malvern, Pennsylvania, Great Valley campus. And after that conversation, he and Norm communicated, and finally, his name is Craig Edelbrook, he asked Norm, do you think you'd be interested in having an exhibition of Amel's work? There was a new gallery that Craig had helped to put together at the Great Valley campus, the Henry Gallery. And Craig said, we could do this in this gallery. And lo and behold, the next thing online was an exhibition of Amel's work at the Henry Gallery, the first one that had been done since his death, as a solo exhibition of his work. So Barry and Norm and myself, we were the curators for an exhibition. Once again, a first for all three of us. But that was just a marvelous, marvelous experience. I believe we had managed to collect the work of 88 pieces of Amel's from people literally across the country, from California to New Jersey, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and we had an absolutely beautiful exhibition. And I can remember walking up the stairs the first day and just being overwhelmed, because it was something we never anticipated, and here it was. And by the same token then, Albert Lakoff, who's the executive director at the Center for Art and Wood in Philadelphia, a very fine organization which promotes woodworking, said, well, would you like to take this show and bring it over to the Center for Art and Wood and then add to it the work of people who were influenced by Amel? One more time, we said, absolutely. So the second show of Amel's work opened at the Center for Art and Wood in Philadelphia, 2015, and was there for several months, during which time there was also, at the opening weekend, there was a symposium that was organized at another public broadcasting station, WHYY, in Philadelphia. And there was a panel discussion by a number of noted art individuals who discussed the times, the work of Amel, how he fit into those times, how he was influenced by that time, as well as our input about what we had found with regard to his life and his work through our research. So once again, when that show closed and we returned everything to its rightful owners, we thought, well, this is it. And then Albert said, well, do you think you would like to have a book come out of this? And of course we said, by all means, that would be wonderful. We talked about this. Wouldn't it be great if there could be a book? But we never imagined the possibility would exist. And that was the initial entry into the publication of the book, which now will be available, finally published in April of 2018.
And sitting before me is a mass of pages anticipating what the book will look like, right?
Yes. You have 272 pages of photographs and the words of both the life and the times in which Amel lived and worked. So it's an interesting compilation, which was done by Craig Edelbrook. He was the one who took our research and wrote the manuscript for the book. And for that, we are extremely grateful once again for what he has done. It's not simply a biography. It's not born, lived, worked, died. It covers the period of time in which he lived, what was going on in the culture, how he was influenced and affected by the culture, and also how, in many ways, he affected what was going on in the times.
There is the material that you have in the archives, but most people won't be able to get to the Smithsonian, but they might have access to this book.
There is a website, and we are involved in a Kickstarter program right now to try to fund the publication of the book. This will continue through the 8th of December. So the book is available in two forms, one a regular edition, or the other is a special edition. The regular edition has all the effects of the special edition, with the exception of the special edition will come with a hard slipcase into which the book will fit. It will be a cherry slipcase. It will have a cutout design of one of Amel's birds on the one face of the slipcase, and on the other face of the slipcase will be one of the quotations that Amel often spoke of and had in his student handout. The website is www.emilmilan.org. There is a Facebook page, which again would be www.facebook.com/ emilan.project/. E-M-I-L-A-N is a conjunction of both his first and last names, and that was how he signed the majority of his pieces, Emilan.
It's a cliche now to hear everybody talking about things that are iconic, but we'll say it in this case. One of the iconic images of all of Emil's photographs is one in which he is actually holding a bird that's in progress. You see him with his work and his machinery and in his work clothes. Do you know about it?
Yes, it's become like the photograph of our project, the Emil Milan Research Team project. Emil is standing in his barn door in his usual attire of a dusty sweatshirt and his trousers, his beret upon his head and his beard, and holding this partially carved bird in one hand alongside of a machine that is a sanding machine, a slack belt sander that he used to sand many of the pieces that he made. It was a design that he had come up with, and it was designed in such a way that it would work with the forms that he made, the curvature. You could push a piece into it and get a curved design. You could make the belt tighter and get a flat sanding area. So it was, we called it the Emil machine, and it was something that was used by a number of artists who went on to try to put together their own type of slack belt sander. But this photograph was taken by a man by the name of Late Johnson. And I believe Late is still living. He is down in Maryland. He was up visiting in Montrose with one of Emil's friends and collectors. And they went over to Emil's barn to chat and talk and maybe drop off some wood for him to use. And Late had a small camera with him. And Emil, being a photographer himself, we found quite a number of photographs that he had taken. He had cameras and he was interested in taking pictures, but when he saw Late come to take his picture with this small camera, there was a little bit of disdain, as the story is told, because so this fellow's a photographer and he's got that little camera. I'm not sure that that's going to be of any value to me. So the gentleman who brought Late to the barn said, let's go back and get your real camera. So they went back and they got Late's real camera. And when they came back to Emil's place and Emil saw the camera that Late now had, his demeanor changed and he was all ready to get his photograph taken. And it just is quite evident that this was a very pleasing moment for him. And it's the only picture that Late ever took of Emil. So we were very lucky to be able to get this photograph. And I've spent a little bit of time talking to Late, as often happens with older people. When you reach a certain age and have to move from one place to another, you discard a lot of things. And he said that, he got rid of all of his photography and all of his photographic equipment. So this piece even takes on a greater importance. Each one of us on the team, I think, has a copy of this photograph. I know I've had one for quite a number of years, and it's on the wall behind my desk where I do a lot of my work.
Norm and Barry and you would have similar things to say about the project because you worked as a team. But what difference has this project made to you?
Well, the project has been absolutely eye-opening in many ways, not only by virtue of the huge amount of information that we were able to discover about Emil, but the contacts that we have made through this whole experience. We have met some very beautiful, wonderful people. Everybody that we've met has had nothing but high respect for and good words to say about Emil. Just to be able to have had those experiences, and quite unfortunately, I think in the last maybe year and a half, five of those individuals have passed away. So had we not been doing what we were doing when we were doing it, we would not have some very significant information it's been something of an odyssey in terms of, you know, the timeline to meet and be with these people. It has, in a way, it has become, in terms of the time that I've spent on it and my colleagues, it's kind of become a decade of our life, much to the chagrin sometimes of our families, who say, you know, when are you going to be done with this project? But at this point, the way things happen, out of nowhere, things occur, people show up, pieces appear, contacts are made. I'm quite sure that we'll never be done with it, although it might get a little easier now that this book is going to be published.
Tell us about the needle image that you use.
Well, I've said that when we started, we were really looking for a needle in a haystack. And as we've gone along, we did find the needle. But the needle had a thread. And that thread has woven this incredible fabric together of individuals and places that probably, had this project never occurred, would have no more of an idea of the value of Emil Molon, or have ever been in touch with each other, because people who had not been in touch with each other for years are all of a sudden now reconnected. The daughter of a woman who was the first director at Peters Valley, who by just a series of coincidence was able to get a video of Emil that was done by one of the people who was a resident at Peters Valley. So that is the only visual and audible information or voice, shall we say, of Emil that we have had. There is another one somewhere possibly out there that we are aware of that was broadcast on a number of public radio stations. But at this point, I think we are pretty much convinced that we will never find it, because of the type of technology of that day. Most of those things were reused or discarded. But we are ever grateful to have this one little segment. Up until that time, the voice of Emil was the work that he did, and the student handout and a couple of quotations that we had from that. That was what he spoke, which was probably in a way more or less like Emil, because the way he taught was not to lecture. He taught by example, and he taught by telling his students, here is what you're going to do, here are the tools, make sure the tools are sharp, go to it. And he would stand by them and just watch them. One fellow said it was almost like he really wanted to be there carving, but he let you go ahead and carve. So, and when he was in Honduras teaching for the USAID program down there, he never learned Spanish, but he managed to teach those people how to do their carving. It definitely is a love and a respect, and we are so grateful that we have been able to find out all this information about Emil, and it has drawn us closer to each other, introduced us to many new people, and really, in effect, it has drawn us closer to Emil. There's one thing I would like to just read from the book, and I think it's just a statement. Would Molon, thinking retrospectively, feel satisfied with the course his life had taken? Did his career fulfill the dreams he may have had as a young whittler turned sculptor? No matter what he thought of his life, and whether he recognized it or not, he was an important figure in American studio woodworking, who had a beneficial impact on the lives of many other woodworkers. In addition to his teaching legacy, the work he produced substantially enriched the American craft world and continues to play that role.
Artist Phil Juris of Hershey, Pennsylvania, and member of the Emil Molon research team with Norm Sartorius and Barry Gordon, artists in woodworking in their own right, speaking with us about Emil Molon, master woodworker at the forefront of mid-century modern design, who made his home here in Thompson in Susquehanna County, instrumental in the growth of the American Craft Council and regional craft organizations, including the New Jersey Designer Craftsman, the Craftsman of the Endless Mountains, and Peters Valley School of Craft, Milan's works are in the Smithsonian American Art Museum, the Yale University Art Gallery, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the Center for Art in Wood, the Museum of Arts and Design, and in many private collections. Over the decade-long project, the Milan research team has been keeping us up to date on the various developments, and they want to report now on the upcoming publication of a significant illustrated biography by the Center for Art in Wood of Emil Milan, Mid-Century Master, by artist Craig Edelbrock, with Phil Juris, Barry Gordon, and Norm Sartorius. Advanced orders will be accepted through December 8th. For more information, on the web, emilmilan.org, and that's E-M-I-L-M-I-L-A-N, emilmilan.org. And the book is Emil Milan, Mid-Century Master, issued by the Center for Art in Wood. It should be out in the first half of the new year. And for more information on the web, emilmilan.org, emilmilan.org.